At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Okay, welcome to the show, everybody. Neil, how's it going this week, man?
It's been a bit of a long one, honestly, but you know, it goes.
And aside from the movie we're about to talk about, have you consumed any media this week?
I've been working my way through Ghost of Tsushima.
So your PC is back up and running, right?
Mostly. It still gets an occasional crash. And I don't know exactly what's prompting it. I think it might be that the graphics card is a little borked.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like the games run fine. And actually, like, I haven't crashed in, like, you know, fingers crossed, knock on wood, I haven't crashed in a game yet since doing some fiddling.
Yeah,
it seems to hate switching tabs in the internet, like in a browser, more than anything.
Weird. Yeah.
That is, like, I don't know, man. That's weird.
I'm not. I've got no clue.
Like that could just be like when I notice it happening, but you know,
Sounds like RAM related to me, but I don't. It's not new RAM. It's like old RAM sticks, right?
Yeah. I got a couple of new RAM sticks with the motherboard package I purchased, but they were lower capacity. So when you guys told me to try just one set, I kept the old ones in.
Okay. Oh, well. Well, yeah, maybe try it with the new one, see if that helps with it. Because that's the only thing that comes to mind for me is the RAM switching. But yeah, I'm glad. So how far are you in Ghost of Tsushima, as we call it around here?
I think I'm... So I play these games wrong, apparently.
Okay, how so?
So I go out and I do all the little side objectives I can find before I progress the main plot. And like there have been like four or five times now where I'm kind of like, man, I wish I had an ability like this. And then I progress the main story and it's like, oh, lo and behold, here's that ability.
Yeah.
would have been nice when I was grinding out bandit camps.
You're talking about the grapple hook, right?
I knew the grappling hook was coming, yeah. In part because I know you, and I know grappling hooks are one of your hallmarks of a great game.
Yeah, that and a train level. Unfortunately, the train hadn't been invented in Samurai Times, so we're kind of out of luck on that.
I did want to tell you that Darktide, the Left 4 Dead style 40k game, recently came out with new content that features a train level.
Oh, hell yeah, that sounds awesome.
Okay, that does sound pretty cool. Okay, sorry, one more Ghost of Tsushima question. Have you, so you rescued your uncle from the castle of Kanada, right?
Yeah, so I'm into act two.
You're in act two,
where I'm trying to recapture my uncle's castle,
right? Gideon, how much of Ghost of Tsushima have you played?
I've beaten it, but I'm not at the moment, but I'm working on the platinum. But yeah, I've beaten it.
Okay, so what I just wanted to make sure I wasn't going to spoil anything. The moment where the leader of the Ronin betrays you in that first, like when you get your uncle out of the castle, that moment was so good. I did not see that coming at all. When he showed up as a boss fight, I was like, oh shit. I thought that part was totally sweet. Neil, do you have the ghost form yet?
Yeah, that was a really cool unlock moment though.
Yeah, the ghost form is totally sick. Okay, anyway, enough about ghosts of Big Chungus. Gideon, how's it going this week, man?
Pretty good. I watched, as far as media, I haven't really been playing too many games lately. Just been busy with other stuff. But I did watch Transformers 1 last night, and that was pretty damn good. Just for being a cool animated Transformers movie with no humans. Still kind of like a family film. But I mean, I feel like if you like Transformers like at all, especially maybe G1 or like the War and Fall of Cybertron games, you'd probably like this movie. Yeah, so it was really fun, minus the these two annoying fucking kids I wanted to reach over and strangle to death. It's literally like 65% of the time I go to a movie in the theater now, somebody is going to ruin it for me. And like to put it in context, and I won't go long about this because I vented about long legs with this, but they literally, like, during the previews, they both left their seats and they're talking at full volume in the middle of the theater and everybody can hear them. And I'm pretty sure like we told on them to the employees and somebody else did. But in the previews, they both like split out from their chairs, went to opposite ends of the theater, and then sprinted back to their seats like it was the fucking McDonald's play place or some shit. No, I was just,
yeah.
I was like, of course. Damn. Fuckers.
Must have seen theaters, got to get some bouncers, man. That's what I'm thinking.
Some ejector seats or something.
Yeah, oh, dude, that'd be sick.
That'd be so awesome. Yeah.
We got to get you to an Alamo Draft House one of these days.
Honestly, definitely. I need that.
Next time you come to Minnesota, we'll take you to the one in St. Paul. It's nice.
Hell yeah, I love that.
Yeah, we love going there. Let's see what I've been up to this week. I finally platinumed shitty ass Final Fantasy 16. So like I love hate platinuming games. Like I never platinum games like in the middle. I always platinum games that I love, and then like ones that I hate so much I feel like I platinum it so I never have to touch it again.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And nobody can be like, oh, you didn't play it or whatever.
Yeah,
or,
you didn't finish it. Exactly. And it's like, no, I did everything and it still sucked. So there's that. I've been playing Control. I'm almost done with Control. I'm really liking that. Playing Space Marine 2. I'm still open to the idea that I might come around on this game, but right now I would say that I'm not liking it. But just to the point where I got the jetpack. Neil, I don't know if you've played up to that point.
No. You know, like I got angry at you in the Discord because I love 40K, but. Honestly, part of it was like the computer was still super janky when I first booted it up. I was struggling a little bit on hard and like not in a fun way.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So I'm happy that this game came out because it's a sequel that I didn't know that was like I didn't think it was ever going to happen. Like I think the original came out like 2012. And I like obviously I haven't made my way through the campaign, so I don't know if the story can carry it. I think it might. I thought it was off to a strong start story wise, but call me a casual. I'm not good at shooting games, and I was really bad at the parry system. So hopefully, Ghost of Tsushima will help me out a bit. But I'm not great with there either. As much as
I don't think it's your fault because I like action games and especially hard games. And I feel like when I booted up Space Marine, it was like, hey, play on hard. They say like this is the intended difficulty, and it's like not difficult in a fun way. It's like. I always have this much health. I'm constantly running around looking for health packs. There's these scenes where it's like there are swarms of rats coming at you that you're supposed to get with a flamethrower, but then there's these flying guys that come in, you have to blast them, but if you're spending the time blasting them out, the rats tend to swarm in, and then you're just like, it's one of those games where it like, it's supposed to be co-op, so you have two computer AI buddies. So every time you go down, it's like not a game over screen. It's a, I'm laying there and waiting for my guys to like come revive me. I don't know, man.
That was actually a major complaint for me was like, you know, I feel like they got this like relatively right back with like the original Gears of War, where like, yeah, you're in the lead, you're taking control of the situation, but
yeah.
The Coltrane and Dom or whoever, like whoever's in your squad, like, you know, they're taking down a Locust or two, like they're keeping the enemy like off your back. And like, so the last mission I played, you're like trying to realign this like satellite dish, and there's a bunch of gargoyles that are attacking these things, and you're supposed to like wipe them out, but then there's Termagants, the little the basic Tyranids that are like swarming around you. And I was like, okay, I can do one of these things, but I'm really struggling to do both, and my companions don't seem to be doing anything.
Between some of that difficulty stuff and between like the level design, I think the gameplay is competent, but I think that the level design is extremely basic. Like the game is basically a series of hallways where you just fight. It's like Dynasty Warriors. You fight waves of dudes, and then, you know, sometimes you get to the end of a hallway and it's an elevator. So you interact with the elevator panel and then you go up and then you go through another hallway. I mean, it's like basically the entire game. So I'm happy that there's like a big budget Warhammer game, and I think for probably guys like you, like big Warhammer fans, they just want to like the swarm tech is really cool, and seeing like the huge vistas and like all the money spent on this game is like a great, you know, I'm happy for you, but as a game, I don't know, man.
I'm gonna reserve judgment. Like, I haven't even played to like the quarterway point, so maybe I'll get better, maybe things will open up, maybe it's just like a rough start, but you know, right now, I'm definitely not going to give it a 5 out of 5.
Okay, now, last gaming-related thing before we started on the movie. Who saw the trailer for Ghost of Yote?
Dude, yeah. Looks sick.
You sent it to me twice, so I had to.
Yeah, looks sweet.
It's going to look crispy, dude.
I'm not the world's biggest Ghost of Tsushima fan, but I'm optimistic because it looks like they're doing, like, I didn't think they were going to do another sequel without having Jin, because people generally really like that first game. So I thought it was for sure going to be like,
agreed.
And I won't talk about like what happens in the ending, but you make a choice in the ending of like, which way is this is going to go. Mm-hmm. So I thought for sure it was like, okay, we're going to do more Jin stuff because it was important enough for him to make that big choice at the end of the game. So like, let's see what the consequence of that action is. And I love that they're tossing away Jin and they're going like, nope, it's 300 years later. There's guns.
Yeah.
Or like muskets, right?
Right.
It's a brand new protagonist. So we have a chance to do some wild other shit with the story. I think that's cool. And I kind of think a third game in the Meiji era, during the era of the American Civil War, but in Japan, would be like perfect. Oh,
Did either of you guys ever watch Rurouni Kenshin, the anime?
I was obsessed with Rurouni Kenshin. Yeah.
My older brother also really obsessed with it. I never watched it. I saw like clips here and there, but it always looked dope.
Gideon, you should go back and watch it.
Okay.
That's awesome.
Like some of the animation is a little dated. There are a couple of OVAs though that are like they came out like in the early 2010s, I think.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, the prequel set is so so good. But okay. Sam, so that you know, in my theme of liking the bad guys, Hajime Saito was my favorite character from that show. The
former... he looks like very does he look very young?
No, he's like he's the leader of, he's one of like the captains of the Shinsengumi, and then he becomes like a police officer. Eventually he's like part of the
team. Yeah, okay. I know who you're talking about. Yeah, yeah. All right.
I mean, I think it would be so cool to, like, to have it during the Japanese Civil War, and like maybe you could even choose, like, are you going to be an imperialist, or are you going to fight for the Shogun as a member of the Shinsengumi? I would love that game.
Yeah, that game would be the tits. And I think that's like, we're like 15 minutes in, we haven't even talked about this fucking movie. Now we're becoming Sacred Symbols, which is a podcast that Gideon and I listen to. That would be awesome. I love that period of Japanese history, because it's like the opening up to the West is so interesting, because like they're bringing in like Gatling guns from Europe, but most people in Japan are like walking around with kimonos and swords still. So it's like this old way of how this country operated is completely done and made like samurai are made obsolete by reloadable firearms and things like that. I don't know. I just think it's so awesome.
Just while we're on the subject, one more time.
No, it's fine.
Do either of you guys ever watch Tom Cruise, The Last Samurai?
Mm-hmm. No, I'm gonna put down the one too.
Oh, I mean, it's great. I don't want to call it historical fiction, because it's based on a real event, and they basically just changed some names. The Battle of Shiroyama, which happened, I think, was it yesterday or 2 days ago, like the anniversary of it. But it's where the Japanese Imperial Army went in and crushed the last samurai revolt.
Damn.
And it's a great movie, and like people get mad because it's like, the cover is Tom Cruise's face and it says The Last Samurai, but like he's not actually claiming to be the last samurai in the movie. It's
okay.
It's people being stupid. I like, very fun movie. I don't know if it's like worth discussing as a movie to watch here, because I think it's like it's simple enough, but I highly recommend it as like a fun popcorn movie that has like some cool like philosophical ideas, I guess.
Oh yeah, cool. I would watch that. I love Tom Cruise.
So speaking of movies,
nice transition.
Yeah, did you see that transition?
Yeah, thank you. We are going to talk about Double Indemnity, which Gideon brought to the podcast. Would you care to tell us why you wanted to bring this, spoiler alert, excellent movie to the show?
I was just trying to think of stuff that, you know, we haven't seen, maybe like, you could call this like a classic film, the stuff like that. Obviously, I don't know about Neil, but me and Sam are pretty big fans of L.A. Noir. I've heard this is like one of the best noir movies. I feel like maybe I have it mixed up with a different movie in my head, or just like the idea of it I had totally wrong. So it was even more unexpected watching it.
What do you mean by that?
I feel like it's like I thought this movie was like about a detective. I honestly thought it was. I might be getting it mixed up with like
you're thinking of the Maltese Falcon.
Because I almost thought Humphrey Bogart was in this movie, but he's not. Right. And I was thinking like a detective in like New York City, smoking cigarettes, trying to figure out some case. Where this is totally different, where it's, you know, they're like he's a con man or on the low basically. But I love black and white movies. I've been trying to get more into just like some film history stuff and watch some older flicks and stuff like that. And just thought it'd be an interesting one to bring, just from I guess a genre and classic film angle of, you know, it's a highly lauded noir movie. It's 80 years old as of this year. And just kind of that angle, I guess. And it was under 2 hours. It seemed like it'd be a pretty breezy one.
Yeah. And, you know, it's been a while on this show since we've done a truly old movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've been kind of more in the modern realm the last couple months anyway. So I was excited to go back and do more of a classic. It's always kind of refreshing. I feel like old movies are... they do a lot with a little. I mean, this movie is a huge positive example of doing just a lot with just not very much.
I will say, before we dig into it too, I was a little worried about picking it when I was watching kind of the first 20 minutes or so. I was like, am I getting too, like, film school, like, teacher, like, professor with. I was like, I don't fucking know, but no, I thought it was fun.
Neil, what did you heard? What did you know about this movie before you? I mean, go ahead with whatever you're going to say, and then tell us what you knew about this movie before Gideon brought it.
You know, I think I had heard the name, and that was about it. But just to speak to Gideon's thought about like being film professor esque, like without giving too much away about my thoughts on it, I think this is like a really interesting step in, like, we've talked before about like the modern movie compared to like when we watched The Grand Illusion, where like, like The Grand Illusion is like, it's almost like an alien made it to our sensibilities. And like this is like not quite a modern movie. Like it's closer. It's like,
you can
see the steps, but it's definitely like a step on the way between The Grand Illusion and something.
Yeah, it's like the chart of the weird fish monster that turns into a monkey and is like Homo erectus, and then, you know, finally humans. Humans would be like the Michael Bay Transformers movies in this case. Yeah. Well, personally, I hadn't really. I think I'd heard the name Double Indemnity before, either as a movie or just the insurance, just the term that the movie is named after. And I think if you pressed me on it, I'd probably say, yeah, it was like an old movie, but I didn't really associate it with being film noir or anything like that. I just heard the title before. And then you watch the trailer and you're immediately, we'll get into how this film is presented if you rent it on Apple TV. You go to rent it, right? And you Double Indemnity, and it pops up and it has like a little rectangle of not a preview, but like a thumbnail of the movie, right? And it's custom art. It's not a screenshot from the movie. And the thumbnail is our lead female character with our lead male protagonist in one reflection of her sunglasses, and the investigator of the insurance, like the claims investigator, in the other reflection of her sunglasses. So this was one of those movies I almost had spoiled for me by the way that the poster was represented. They present her as being like, if not innocent, fairly sympathetic, right? And then the whole crux of the movie is like, oh no, she did, like, she's actually a totally evil psycho hose beast bitch and is like playing everybody in this movie. But I knew that because that's the way that the thumbnail looks on the Apple TV menu. Like, she's posed in this very, like, she's playing all sides of it. She's the only one who really knows what's going on. So that's a little bit annoying. I wish people wouldn't people have to think about how they make thumbnails. I will also say this reminds me of many, many movies that we've done on this podcast where it seems like it would be more effective if you had seen it when it had come out, because I think many of the probably groundbreaking things about this movie seem a little pedestrian in 2024. Oh, yeah. Like, I think the start of it, like the framing of it, was probably mind-blowing back in the day, where it like starts at the end, you know, Quentin Tarantino style, and he's like leaving a message and he tells the whole, and that, like, that's how the story is told from the perspective. It's like in media res, he's already like dying from his gunshot wound, and then he just so you're constantly thinking, it's like, how are we going to get back to that point? That part is very clever.
What I was going to say is, like, I knew nothing about this movie going into it, and then within like the first 5 minutes, like, I was like, oh, I've seen this movie before. I've never watched Double Indemnity, but I've seen this movie before.
Yeah, it's 1000% the beginning of Uncharted 2 when he like reaches down and he's like, that's my blood, that's a lot of my blood, and then he passes out, and then it tells this, like, the first half of the game is leading up to that point where he gets shot. So like you finally, you're like, once he gets shot, you're like, oh, okay, there we go. We're about to catch up. I don't know. I mean, where do you even start with this movie? So basic synopsis, and feel free to interrupt or add detail. Our main guy, first name something, last name
Walter Neff.
Neff, okay,
that's the character.
Yeah, Neff is like an insurance salesman.
Uh-huh.
Goes to this guy's house to sell him some insurance. Guy's not home. It's wife, and they're immediately making eyes at each other. Immediately, the dialogue in this movie sizzles. Like, it's okay. It's not very realistic dialogue.
No,
nobody talks hell, this. Though. It's so awesome. Like, I love this old school film noir dialogue where people are like, sure, it's 10 dimes, make a dollar, baby. You know, I love that shit. It's not realistic, but it is so fun to listen to. And the acting is so, like, it's not bad. It's just so different. And it's very, like, we're in a movie in the 1940s, and it's not realistic. But it's very serviceable for what the... And you feel the chemistry between those two immediately. Like, they have a great on-screen chemistry. They do a great job, those two immediately. So, so she, you know, basically seduces this guy and is like, you're going to help me kill my husband. And you're going to help me take out a huge insurance claim without him knowing. And then we're going to kill him. And then we're going to get the money and we're going to run away together. And then basically that kind of thing. And I guess the other fault of the story is that because he's the insurance salesman, he works with the guys who investigate what they suspect to be faulty insurance claims. So this guy is like breathing down his neck the entire time. And it's kind of like the cat and mouse between Neff and what's the insurance salesman or the claims agent's name?
Like his boss, Barton Keyes?
It's Keyes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you guys catch the name of Keyes and Neff, their boss, their superior, when they get pulled into his office? Did you see what his name on the door was?
Is it Mr. Diedrichson?
No, Diedrichson is the guy that they killed.
Okay.
It's Edward Norton.
What the fuck?
They refer to him as Mr. Norton, and then they shut the door and it says Edward Norton on the door. That's, and I was like, so oh, shit. Funny. Okay. What do you know? Small world. Awesome. I mean, where do we want to start with this, guys? I mean, we kind of gave a brief synopsis. I mean, you can infer that it's a film noir. I mean, things are going to get messy. Things are going to get crazy. They don't just get away with it, right? So,
I do want to take a quick sidebar, just kind of while you talked about the Apple TV presentation, almost like spoiling the movie. I read about this article today, and it was like someone was watching Psycho by Hitchcock on Apple TV Plus, and you know, at the spoilers for Psycho, at the end he's staring at the camera being like a psychopath, right? And apparently it, like, you know, it's like gonna roll credits, so it minimizes, it's like, okay, up next is whatever, so it put it in the corner, and it's like, up next is Big Bang Theory, and I was like, what in the fuck is happening?
The movie's not even over. He's like still looking up at the camera, and it like moves him, and it's like Big Bang Theory up next. I was like, oh my god, Alfred Hitchcock thing.
And so, like, the way I watched this, I just rented the Blu-ray from the library. I've just been really obsessed with like physical media the past couple years, and trying to watch things physically and experience that way. It didn't have a main menu, so I thought that was kind of strange. It just kind of started. But I think it's interesting how the way you pick and choose on how to experience a movie, even something like this, and they can be like nonchalantly spoiling it.
Well, I mean, that even happened to me with, like, have you guys seen Parasite?
Yes.
No.
Okay. So, Neil, I won't go into detail, but, Parasite is rated R, and the movie goes a long time without anything R rated happening. And then in a scene late in the movie, there's a knife on a table. And I was like, I know exactly what's going to happen in this scene. Because nothing has happened yet that would necessitate an R. And there's a sharp knife on that table. It's like, here we go. Like, this is going down right now. So, I mean, people got to be careful. Like, it's almost a spoiler to know how long a movie is. It's almost a spoiler to know what the rating is. It's like, if you're a perceptive person, the thumbnail, the box can be a... Like, There's just like a lot of, it's like when you're playing a game and they pretend like a character's dead, and then you like you play another level or whatever and you're going through it with like just the one character, but then there's stuff in the level that the only the other character can like activate or access or whatever. You're like, that guy's gonna be fine because I gotta come back and get that treasure chest in the back, whatever. Anyway, yeah, they gotta be careful about shit like that. So let's just go like high level. Neil, you enjoyed this movie?
Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah.
I think a lot of my complaints aren't real complaints. Again, I think it's just more that this was made in a different time. You know, it's closer to 100 years old than it is 50 years old.
Right.
And we've kind of talked about like the anachronisms in this movie. Like, I like so from like an anthropology standpoint, it's always interesting to listen to these old movies because like since like World War II, like the American language has changed in like the cadence and like how we emphasize certain words, and just like the general bearing of people. And obviously like there's a difference between like how people act in the real world and in a movie. But like, I just love like the 1944 version of a handsome tough guy. Like he's still got his like belt pulled up around like above his belly button, and
his tie is like that long,
and he's like probably a little paunchy if we stripped him down. If you catch the guy in profile, he doesn't have a chin. Fred McMurray, like I think he does a great job playing the character, but like I was just looking at him and was like when you're like making threats and like giving the tough guy act, I'm not buying it just looking at you. Somehow I think he carries it on personality, but like
it doesn't seem like when he chokes out that guy in the back of the car, I was really glad that they did that off screen because I was like, I don't buy, you know, he just doesn't seem like he's gonna snap somebody's neck. He just seems like he could like work as a general manager at Hy-Vee.
Yeah, and like again, going back to like sort of like the evolution of movies and like the progression of characters, I'd be willing to bet that this is like the first time that like the protagonist of a movie murders somebody in cold blood. Or at least like in a mainstream movie. Because like nowadays like you get like John Wick and you know, yeah, he's the good guy, but he like decreased the population of New York by 2% over the course of the film. And we're fine with that. But I think like our protagonist and narrator went out of his way to murder somebody is very strange. And I think it would have been very shocking to people of the time.
Mm-hmm. And that they're like adulterers too.
I feel like that was maybe a little more like oh my gosh, it's so risque at the time. But like that was a little more probably like something that had happened before, but yeah.
They are kind of nonchalant about the fact that they're adulterers and then going to commit murder. Like it did seem to me like the plan came together pretty quickly and then they were like pretty okay with it.
Yeah, so that's kind of where I want to go. Just one quick sidestep. I was actually familiar with Fred McMurray. I went through because I felt like I'd recognize some of these people. And I'm familiar with Fred from a 1966 movie called Follow Me Boys, which is man moves to a new town and immediately takes over the local Boy Scout troop. Cool. Like, we watched it like for every Boy Scout like sleepover at the church because it was non-offensive and it was scout related. So I knew him as the friendly neighborhood scout master who just, you know, in retrospect, just like wandering off into the field with a bunch of boys who are not related to him in any way.
It was a different time.
Boy Scout.
But
my dad was telling me about being in Little League in the 70s. They went to, like, state, right? And in those days, you didn't like the whole, your family didn't come with you and you got a hotel room and then you played in the state tournament and you stayed over the weekend because nobody could afford it. So what they did was all the kids stayed at random people's houses in the town where the state tournament was being held. Like there were people that just signed up for like, yeah, we'll host Little League boys in our house and feed them for the next couple of days while they're here in town. And then they can come back here and sleep between ball games.
That is wild.
I know. Like when he told me that, I couldn't fucking believe it. I was like, are you shitting me? That's like a pedophile's dream. He's getting like DoorDashed.
Yeah. Oh my God. Jesus. I needed that the tip. Oh my God.
So it was a different, my point is, it was a different, gentler world at some point.
But also, like, I think, again, just going through like the IMDb profiles of these people, like Edward Robinson, the guy who plays the actuary who works with Neff, he was like a secondary antagonist in the Ten Commandments and was in Soylent Green.
Oh,
amazingly.
Right.
The women weren't in anything else that I recognized, but like all these actors, I think probably is a product of it being like this movie being made during World War II. So like the male actor pool is probably a little shallow and that let some people like make a name for themselves who might not have otherwise. Like all the actors in this movie are in like at least five other movies and shows together.
Hmm.
Like their IMDb pages have just a ton of crossover.
But yeah, and I'm not really quite sure of like the history of how the studio system worked, but isn't that kind of how things were back in this period? Like you were signed with a particular studio and then basically they would just call you for anything that they needed you for, right? Like
I'm sure there was an element of that. But okay. Getting back to the movie and sort of like the film history aspect of it. One thing that really stood out to me is that this movie is like in modern movies, like you don't want too much expository dialogue. There's the phrase, you know, you want to show, don't tell. Like if you want to have a situation where you have a loving couple, you want like pictures of them on their honeymoon on the piano and on the mantelpiece. You know, they have like casual touches and they like kiss and hug each other. And like, you don't have to have them say, oh, I love you so much, Robert. You're just, this movie is like all tell and no show. Where like Neff walks into this house, like you might get the impression that he might just be like flirtatious towards women, all women, but within two meetings of meeting Phyllis, also just the throwback of like
the names,
the sex appeal of a woman named Phyllis, like
yeah, right, yeah.
But like within two meetings, like he is ready to
murder
a man or. I'll plug the values of the insurance policies into a inflation calculator in a sec for like two of my yearly salaries. Like okay,
yeah. It is quaint, and the movie is certainly like quaint to look back on. The thing that I really appreciated about it were the scenes where it built an unbelievable amount of tension based on nothing but characterization and dialogue. I mean, that's all this movie has is the way that is like the script. Like the script just kicks so much ass that like when Diedrichsen has been murdered and then they're like all like Norton and Keyes and Neff are all in the insurance office talking to each other. And then she walks in. And they're not supposed to know each other, right? Like the tension there of thinking that she was going to break at any second was so good. The scene where like Keyes comes to his apartment, and she's there and she has to hide. And you're like, oh my God, like that scene is really good. Or like even the scene where he's first getting the husband to sign the insurance claim and he doesn't really know what he's signing. And there's like a lot of eye contact going on between her and him about, like, okay, this is the first step. This is the first domino in getting this whole thing. Like, the tension that's just built up, and excellent direction and cinematography. And the camera just, like, does a lot of the work in telling you what you need to know in the relationship between all these people. It was incredibly well done. I think Neil made a good point. In comparison to something like The Grand Illusion, which was less than a decade before this, it's almost unthinkable that this movie came out right next to something, you know, within such a short span of something like that, which was almost prehistoric. I also think that is largely telling of the differences between, like, how far ahead of the rest of the world Hollywood was in film production compared to even another first world country like France. So,
Sam, please.
Well, you know, all things considered, you know, like, so yeah, I mean, just so, and sometimes you watch an old movie and they're just a stinker, but this had a lot of good tension. I will say, I think the movie for me, it's not that it's too long, it's that when it reveals its hand, like, as soon as she shoots Keys and then he shoots her, the movie's over. Like, everything after that to me is just like, let's hurry this up because I know where this is going.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's only like maybe 15, 20 minutes after that point. Yeah. You know, if that, but like, once you find out how he got shot, the movie is based, the ride is over, and you're deboarding the train at that mm-hmm. point. But yeah, I can't really think of too much to complain about aside from the, you know, just again, it grossed me out how close people talk in old movies like this, because they're like chain smoking and drinking, and everybody just fucking reeks. All maybe they can't smell it because everybody smelled like that, but right. Everybody's talking like, people are talking, like, having conversations. This is, oh, I love you, baby. As sure as 10 dimes make a dollar. And it's like right there. It's like, it's so gross. Like, I can't get over, like, how unromantic some of the scenes are when they're, like, this close to each other. is that just a me thing? Does that gross anybody else out?
No, I mean, I did think that was really funny that you mentioned that. And just, like, yeah, thinking about how they're just... And it's like, how many takes, you know, how many different cigarettes in one scene is he fucking smoking? And he's smoking them all for real because it's in the 40s. You know? Yeah. Man, yeah. Yeah. Like, I feel like just kind of the age, and just sometimes with older films, it's like, I get why some people maybe be like, oh, this is boring, or what is going on? Like, you know, but it's just like, yeah, it's just the time and the place. And I feel like you kind of have to try and put yourself in that, like, film history mode to get more out of it with that kind of thing. But just a few things I wanted to mention that you had kind of touched on. Yeah, I mean, obviously the script does so much heavy lifting, and there's a lot of really quotable, snappy dialogue. I was, like, joking with Alyssa watching it, and I was like, yeah, like, me handing you my coat, like, hey, sweetheart, park this for me. She just, like, slaps me. Like, or, like, with the cool factor, like, I was like, damn, like, they're all striking these matches with their thumb. Like, holy shit. Like, that was cool. I was like, I just break the fucking match, especially with quality these days. It's probably made out of fucking recycled used toilet paper or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was a point where Phyllis lights a cigarette, and I was like, damn, that match has been on for like 45 seconds. I can't get a match to light for like 15 before it burns out on me.
Yeah, they were making matches out of sturdier stuff back in the day, because they had to, right? I mean, these people were chain smoking like it was
triply poisonous as well, too.
Yeah, and the result of the flame is much more dramatic too. I mean, it's not just like it's like, I mean, it's like a fireball coming off the end of those suckers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would be really interested to learn about, like, surely they had fake herbal cigarettes, but I don't think they thought smoking was as bad for you, so maybe they just really smoked that much.
Doctors used to prescribe cigarettes.
That's what I was going to say, for, like, weight loss and anxiety, maybe, and shit like that. Yeah. And didn't they like almost laugh it off that it was bad for you at first?
Yeah.
They were like, whatever.
No, 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 Sam. Your competitor's product is poison. Yours is toasted.
It's toasted.
Dude, I saw the best variation of that ever. It was like Don Draper with like the broccoli hair haircut, like the Zoomer haircut. And he was like, other people's cigarettes are cap. Lucky Strike is buzzing.
Oh my god.
They were either ignorant to the fact that smoking was bad for you, or more likely I'm sure people had an inkling that it was bad for you, but they were lying to themselves about how bad it was for you because nobody wanted to quit, I think is probably more accurate.
Yeah.
So I had one other thought. I didn't bring this up when Sam asked about other media we've been consuming because I wanted to talk about it here. But I'm sure this was kind of revolutionary again in terms of like, you know, the ending before from, you know, the ending from the beginning. Did either of you guys ever watch, I think it was like a late 60s, early 70s series called Columbo?
I've heard of it. Have not.
No, but my grandma loves that show.
So it's a detective show. And like each episode was actually like a TV movie. So it was like six episodes per season and you get like an hour and 20 minute long episode.
So like a BBC show.
Kind of. Yeah.
Yeah.
So each one's a murder mystery. But the gimmick at the time, and this was also kind of groundbreaking, is that you as the viewer see the murder take place. So you know who it was, how they did it. And, you know, it's always it's always the perfect murder somehow. Like, you know, no fingerprints, no, like, obvious way to track who it is. And so the point of the show is then watching Columbo find the clues and figure out how to finger the perpetrator through like non-traditional detective means. And I recently watched one just as like a standalone episode, and it was actually very interesting to watch. And but again, just like in that progression, but going backwards, with that in mind, watching this, like I kept wait, and this is gonna basically factor into my rating. Is like I kept waiting for a twist, and I know that like probably like historically the twist was, oh my gosh, we know like he admitted to killing a man for money and a woman, and we're gonna see how it happens. But I kept waiting for something in the story to be a shocking revelation, and there wasn't one. In part because, like I said, I've seen this movie before. I knew the moment that he looked up at Phyllis and she's like in her like bath towel staring down at him, like, oh, this is the femme fatale. Like she's the bad person here.
Mm-hmm.
Now obviously
I think that was the twist back in the day.
Yeah.
Like when it's revealed that the daughter's boyfriend is also seeing Mrs. Dietrichson, and she's like manipulating the whole situation with like several, like at least two different men at the same time, like then that's when you're like, oh shit. But again, yeah, you're right. Like it seems very quaint by today's standards. You're like, yeah, of course.
It's like, it's a cliche. It wasn't a cliche at the time.
Right.
But for me, it's just like, I know this story beat for beat. And I needed Rian Johnson to come in and subvert my expectations somewhere.
Yeah. I understand what you mean. I was always disappointed. I think the ending of Rear Window is a little disappointing for the same reason, because they don't make it like it's they make it like almost too clear what happened. They're like, and I know that sounds weird for me because I like things being explained in movies, but like the ending of that movie is very flat in a way that I think is like undercuts the rest of what is otherwise like a totally perfect movie. But yeah, I understand. Like sometimes like the flatness of storytelling from this era, and just like they they set it up and they just deliver it to you. And because you had spent your entire life pushing a stick, pushing a hoop with a stick down a dirt road, you still think it's the greatest thing ever because you're like watching a movie, you know, it's like, it doesn't matter how flat it is. But I think otherwise it's like just a totally stellar, well-executed, sharply paced, kind of easy breezy, beautiful looking movie. So, you know, I really enjoyed it. What do we, we're about the 50 minute mark, so we need to get to ratings somewhat soon. Does anybody have any last thoughts or last words or anything they want to bring up before we close out?
I guess I have a few small things. Yeah. Also kind of like how you had talked about with like the character's eyes, like giving lots of information. It like worked and didn't work for me when they brought in that guy that like saw him at the end of the train, but he only saw him from like behind. I was like, don't you recognize like how tall he is? And I was like, also, don't you recognize his voice? Like, you did talk to this guy. I felt like that was a little not as believable, but I could forgive it, you know. And as far as just some of the shots and things, I did think it was really pretty at times. I did like seeing the office that they worked in. And there was like a shot where it like panned down, you see all the desks and everybody working below. And like seeing the house that the woman lived in. I thought it was hysterical how they're like $30,000 house and they're still paying it off. I was like, Jesus Christ, I fucking wish. And then I mean probably my favorite shots in the whole movie was when he is driving erratically. I was like, oh my god, like this movie's like 80 years old and they got my gameplay of me driving to the next case in LA Noir, you know, just driving like a maniac. I really like that, and seeing like the people like working on the trolley or whatever the fuck it was in the beginning. I like the opening shots of the movie quite a bit, actually. Yeah, so I don't know, interesting movie. I thought it was a fun mystery. Yeah,
you know, I think an underrated aspect of movies from this era as well, at least for me, is getting to live in that time period for a little bit while you're watching it. It's just such a, like, I know this is about a murder and I shouldn't be describing it as like cozy, but I always feel this way with like Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo. I know that this is like Hollywood and not reality, right? So it's all romanticized to some degree, but watching Jimmy Stewart Vertigo drive around like early 1960s, like late 1950s, San Francisco, when it was like still pristine and beautiful, and it's just a pleasure to like exist in this perfect world where like everybody's dressed so beautifully, and like you go into the grocery store and the grocery store shelves are unbelievably well stocked and everything is straight and perfect. And or like even his office building is just like so beautiful, and like all the big glass panes everywhere, and I'm just like watching them drive around LA is such a treat.
When they dropped off the daughter for Nino, and you see that brief shot of like the street and the people behind him and everything, and he like flicks the cigarette, I'm like, damn. Yeah, like I agree, that is one thing I really love about older movies. And it's like, yeah, it's basically a period piece, but it's just how it was back then. You know, I'm sure there's some stuff that's props and sets and whatever, but
And you know, like I think up until like even scarily recently, you know, 1946 or 7 was like the most violent year in LA's history in terms of murders. So I'm not saying everything was dandy, but it's still fun to like watch a movie where you get to live in such an appealing part of it. You know, it's like what I loved about American Graffiti. It's weirdly what I love about Blade Runner. That sounds crazy. But, you know, it's just fun to go, like, live in a see, you know, something so different like that. It's appealing. We got to watch Vertigo for that same reason. Like, Vertigo was, like, the ultimate movie of, like, God, I just want to live here. This is, like, the most beautiful city I've ever seen in my life. Neil, any last words, last thoughts?
I just want to give one last shout-out to the actor who plays Keyes, Edward Robinson. I think that he was... Yeah. The strongest performance in the movie. I wish he had been in more of it. Even like, I kind of agree that like the last 20 minutes that features him pretty heavily is could have used some reworks, but I think he was on point.
Dude, there is a scene in this movie where I laughed out loud because his acting was so good. He gave this like really long, intense speech, and then he like drank this water and he spilled it all over himself in like the excitement. And he, like, I just laughed out loud. I thought that was so, that was like really great. I don't know if he meant to do that, but I'm so glad that they kept it.
He was very believable. Yeah, I agree.
One little fold in this movie. So, Gideon, you know that I just played Alan Wake, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the name of the FBI agent? Nightingale. That's like chasing you around everywhere. He's like firing erratically. He's like really weird. Nightingale has this weird tick of every time he is like talking to Wake, he calls him by the name of another author, like another famous author. He's like, I got you now, Stephen King. I got you now, Hemingway, or whatever. There's one scene in Alan Wake where he says, hand it over, Raymond Chandler. Raymond Chandler is the guy who wrote Double Indemnity.
Oh, nice. Okay,
so
cool.
So as soon as it popped up, written by or screenplay by Raymond Chandler, I was like, oh shit, I know who that is, because he's mentioned briefly in Alan Wake.
Wow.
Literature.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So a little
cool thing those threads, you know. Yeah.
Sure. Well, so what are we thinking for ratings, boys?
I'll go last.
Okay. Neil, what's your verdict, man?
My initial gut reaction was to give it a 2. And okay. I'm gonna wind up giving it a 3 because I feel like 2 is too harsh. It's not its fault that it's dated. Mm-hmm. And I'm not upset that I watched the movie. I can't see myself ever watching it again, at least not this version of it. I'm sure I'll see its successor at some point. But yeah, I think just like for me, the ultimate issue is just that it is dated, and like I've seen all the themes, all the tropes, all the cliches in this movie in more recent movies that, you know, just play to my sensibilities more. So it's a 3. It's not that it's a bad movie. I'm sure it was groundbreaking on some level. It's just the progression that I'm working with.
Yeah, you know, I completely understand that. I think that's a good point. You know, it's like some of its faults are that it's old, so you don't want to like knock it too much because it really can't help itself. But you know, it's still not your favorite movie in the world. So I think that's a fair place to come down. I'm gonna go ahead and say 4. I really enjoy Double Indemnity. That's not particularly novel to say. You know, it's like so legendary. I like movies that are set in you know, this is not a modern setting by today's standards, but I mean, like, not science fiction and not fantasy. I think, like, modern settings are, generally speaking, my favorite kind of movies. I love noir. I love the fact that it's a mystery. I love the snappy dialogue between them. It's sharp. It's quick. It's very script-focused, which is another thing I'm usually really into. So, what keeps it from being a 5? I would just say, you know, like, again, it's that whole, like, 5s are really reserved for, like, I was blown away and just not, this movie knocked it out of the park for me. Or it's gotta be, like, a subject matter that I'm personally really, really into. I will say this in the game immediately made me want to go, like, boot up L.A. Noire. If I hadn't hit played L.A. Noire, like, last year and did everything, I would have immediately, like, gotten booted up L.A. Noire. Which, Neil, if you've never played L.A. Noire, one of the funniest video games ever created. I laugh out loud every time I play Eleanor.
Yeah, it's fucking funny as hell.
Yeah, man, it's so funny. Spare me your, what is this? Spare me your left, your drivel, you left-leaning parasite.
Just literally Google, like, L.A. Noire Cole Phelps insult compilation, and that you'll, dude, that is a gold mine.
So what about you, Gideon?
For me, I fall in a similar camp with Neil. My knee-jerk initial reaction is like a 3 out of 5. And I feel like it's just because it's a bit older. I really wanted to like love this movie. It's highly lauded in lots of different ways with like noir and just classic film. I think it has like an 8.3 on IMDb, like a 4.3 on Letterboxd or something. But it does just kind of feel a bit very straightforward and not like the punch doesn't hit as hard just because of its age. And I want to give it a 4. I feel like maybe eventually I'll be able to get to a 4 with this movie. But it also kind of feels like I'm just too dumb to fully appreciate and understand everything about this movie. But I feel like, you know, watching this with like a commentary track and just like learning more about it, I could grow to admire it more. But yeah, initially, I think I'm going to go with a 3 for me personally.
Yeah. Well, I think those are all very fair ratings, and I think you guys explained yourself well. So who are, is it Neil's turn next week?
I think so.
Yes, and so what's it going to be, man?
All right, so I'm feeling a little nostalgic. Okay. I also, since we're meeting in 2 weeks, we're going to be into spooky season.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I feel like maybe doing you guys a favor as far as having a date night with your ladies.
Is it Hocus Pocus?
No.
Damn.
So, but I'm torn between two choices. So, number one is the 1991 Addams Family.
Okay.
Okay.
Or the 2020 movie Love and Monsters.
Love and Monsters. I haven't seen either of those. Okay.
Sam, do you have a preference between the two?
No. These look... I've never heard of Love and Monsters. I've never seen the 1990s Addams Family movie.
Same.
Ooh, okay.
I actually don't know hardly anything about the Addams Family. I'm going to be perfectly honest.
I know very little.
So... From my perspective, Love and Monsters, like just based on the time that it came out, like really snuck in under the radar for a lot of people, I think. Like 2020, like who was going to movies. But I think it's a hidden gem. But for cultural relevance, then I'm going to have you guys watch the 1991 Addams Family.
Okay. Hell yeah.
Yeah, I can definitely do that, man. I think that's it's a hell of a pick. Yeah, and I suppose we are in spooky season. I don't know. It's very body horror-y, so I don't know if I'm going to do it because I'm trying to... I don't want to kill myself. But I kind of have an idea of what I would like to do for the next time I'm up.
What do you got? I'm curious.
Oh, speaking of which, Grace watched the David Cronenberg, The Fly. And said it was totally awesome.
Nice.
So there's that. I wanted to do the Japanese movie Audition.
Oh yeah. Okay. I've only heard about it.
Okay. Yeah. Same. I've never seen it. I know some key details about the last bits of Audition. Kind of a Bone Tomahawk situation where I kind of know some of the bits going into it, but we'll see. Anyway, so we'll get there. So yeah. So, are we going to go back to every 2 weeks now that Pentiment is over?
I think that would probably work best for me. I don't mind doing it every week, but sometimes I just need a break
for like a week. Sure. Yeah. Well, let's just see how we feel. I feel like during spooky season, we're going to like want to do a lot of them because like Halloween movies are so fun.
I feel like it's also easier in the colder months and like winter to get a bunch of watching stuff done.
Yeah. That's certainly true. Of course, we all live in very snowy, harsh places. All right. So have a good week, everybody. Tomorrow is PlayStation 5 Pro pre-order day to all who celebrate.
Hell yeah.
Nice. So 10 a.m. I'm going to be trying to get my 30th anniversary bundle.
Hell yeah.
From my office at work. We'll see if I'm able to do so. It's probably going to be a complete shit show.
I believe.
I probably won't get anything. So that'll be super awesome. So have a good week, everybody. If I don't talk to you,
tune in next time to find out if Sam got a PS5 Pro.
Oh yeah, if I'm crying at the beginning of the next episode, you'll know exactly what happened. No, I can only play at 30 frames a second. No,
God damn it.
We become so spoiled so quickly. I'm pretty sure I played Shadow of the Colossus on PlayStation 2 at 12 frames a second for the entire time. And now I'm like, if it's not 60, who cares? All right. All right, I'll see you guys next week.
Have a good one, guys. Later.